Thank you. So I'm going to talk about improved chiral lattice fermion actions that attempt to get chiral symmetry to higher precision with smaller cost. Tony Kennedy yesterday gave a very good description of the subject of approximating overlap operators. So here today I'm going to focus on one particular class of operators that we developed with Rich Brouwer and Hartmut Neff from BU. And so I will going to give a small introduction to lattice chiral fermions. I'm going to take a different path than what Tony took yesterday. I'm going to get something that is closer to the historic to the time sheet, the historic way that chiral fermions were discovered during the last century. So then, so this is my, at the end, after I go through the introduction, I'm going to make a few comments about the Ginsberg-Wilson relation and then describe the improvements that we have seen working in the world of domain wall fermions. I'm not going to say anything about continued fractions since Tony described this yesterday, and then go on and conclude and say a few things about how we see the future here. So it all started, as I said, at the end of last century by a paper by David Kaplan, where he realized that if you put an extra fifth dimension and you put the mass term of the fermion to depend on this fifth dimension in this manner, you can see that you localize on this mass defect low energy chiral mode. So this is the basic idea of how these actions get produced. One realization of this idea suitable for QCD is the so-called domain wall fermions, where in fact you put a five-dimensional space where it has two boundaries, and the gauge field is only four-dimensional. It lives on the slices in four-dimensional slices in this extra dimension, and it's easy to show that in the free field, if you choose the mass of the four-dimensional Wilson operator, which is the kernel operator for the hopping of the fermions in the four dimensions. If you choose it to be negative, then you get one light flavor with chiral symmetry as the effective theory on the boundaries. You can this is exactly massless. You can introduce mass by explicitly coupling the two boundaries with a mass term, and it's all explained originally by Samir and Thurman and Samir. These are the early papers on that. So in this formulation, we have an explicit realization of the chiral symmetry in this five-dimensional space. You separate the chiral transformation in this space is a little bit weird. You separate the space into two parts, and on the left part you do a vector rotation with a negative angle, and on the right-hand world you do a vector rotation with a positive angle. Now, if you do this transformation, you can derive the Noether current, and you find that an axial current whose divergence is given by this form. You have a term that it is the pseudoscalar density that it is proportional to the fermion mass, and you have an additional term, and then plus some contact terms that depend on the operator. So this pseudoscalar density is built out of the Q, Q bar fields, which are constructed from the chiral components on the boundaries of this of this five-dimensional space. And it has a regular form, Q bar gamma 5Q. Now, this additional term is constructed by the fermion fields in the midplane. So obviously, there is a breaking term that occurs at the place where the left-handed and the right-handed components coincide. And this is one location is the middle, and the other location is the boundaries. So the axial current is a sum over vector-like currents in the four-dimensional world, but they come with plus sign where they are from this side of the world, and with minus sign when they are from this side of the world. I have to mention that this current and the breaking terms are invariant on the location of this mid-plane. You can move it around at will. So obviously, as you take the LS at infinity, because the modes are exponentially localized on the walls, the overlap in the middle is getting exponentially small, so you recover exact chiral symmetry at the finite slotted space. That is the physical picture of these domain wall fermions. Another realization of chiral fermions comes from work done by Narayanan and Neuberger, where they realized that you can write down the action of a chiral fermion as the overlap of two vacua in a space in a theory with many flavors. Many flavors, you can think of them as an extra dimension. So they were able to integrate out these extra flavors and come up with the effective theory that describes the chiral fermion. And the operator has this form, where this epsilon here is the sine function of this kernel operator, which is nothing but the four-dimensional Wilson fermion operator. So what this a mapping of this kernel operator to the overlap operator does is the following. In the free field theory, if you take, so I have to mention that this M5 has to be negative, if you take the spectrum of the free field Wilson Dirac operator at some negative match, let's say minus one, you have this distribution of eigenvalues. So this operator here is a unitary operator, so it takes this spectrum and projects it onto a circle. So you add a half, and then you move the circle this way. So at this place here, you at very small momenta, you see that the spectrum looks like IP slash, which is the free fermion spectrum. So that's all what this operator does. So there was another attempt of finding good lattice actions for fermions, which went under the name of perfect actions. In this game, you would devise an RG transformation where you take fine degrees of freedom and you have a blocking kernel to map them onto a coarse set of degrees of freedom. And then by path integral here, you construct the effective action of these coarse degrees of freedom. So these are now, in this case, this phi, you can think of it as a fermion field. I didn't write what its action is. No, in this case, I'm writing down, say, for a scalar field. I am not going to describe it as a fermion, but if you want, but you have to do it with a gauge field together. And then, if you want to do it with a gauge field, then it gets complicated, and there is no explicit solution. So, but. As a mnemonic for any, I'm just demonstrating the concept here of any RG. This T here is a function that relates, that takes, for example, it could be you integrate over the phi field in. What? Forget about mu. Forget about mu now. Look about this form now, from over here. So this is the concept. So now, I don't know. So anyway, so if you iterate this RG transformation, then you end up with a fixed point action. Now, in the case of the fermion, you can show that even non-perturbatively, even if you have the gauge fields and you do the full blocking, the perfect action crowd can show that this relation is satisfied by their operator. Now, if we go back if we go back to Ginsberg and Wilson, which worked about 10 years before the perfect action crowd did their work, they did the free field case, where now there are no new fields in here, which can be done exactly. And you can start from the continuum, and then you derive that this is the relation that your operator satisfies. Yes. Yeah, it's an approximation to this path integral, right? It's a classical approximation.
It's a classical approximation with base bar that is associated with the main unit, it's set to zero, and and you still have loop collection, which is to be a loop extension.
Okay, so it's a function of a new, yes. No. Fine. I agree about that. But here I'm trying to say how this Hilbert-Wilson that it makes all this noise was derived. I'm not saying that this produced a solution. I'm not saying that this work produced a solution to the Carroll fermion problem on the lattice. Here, I have to stress that. But anyway, it turns out that the overall operator that you derived satisfies this relation. Now, that's why a lot of people are calling those fermions Ginsberg-Wilson fermions, which I think it's unfair for the reasons that you probably say. And here is an example why. Okay, so let me give now a small argument here that why Ginsberg-Wilson is not everything. And here is an example, because if you take the mass positive, so this operator here satisfies Ginsberg-Wilson. Now, if you take the same argument as I did before to understand why the spectrum looks like this, this is the situation. So if you do the unitary projection, everything gets projected down here. So instead of having a Carroll fermion, you have 16 massive fermions. Okay, good. So, okay, so now let's go back to the domain wall fermions. So, at heart, domain wall fermions are the same as the overlap. So, there must be some way that we can see that there is a Ginsberg-Wilson type of relation underlying it this way. And it's actually very easy to show that. If you integrate out all the fermions, it has been done in the literature many times by many authors. So you find that there is an operator that looks like this, and this epsilon is an approximation to the sine function. The kernel operator now is a little bit more complicated. It has this form. And this effective propagator of the Q bar Q fields that I defined previously is given by this relation here. And this, the overlap is this operator up there. Now, the particular approximation to the same function that this domain wall mechanism implements is this, which is something that Tony actually showed yesterday, I think. And now if you put it into the Ginsberg-Wilson relation, then you find that it's not exactly satisfied, but it is broken by this particular term here. So one remark that I wanted to make here, if LS is positive, so this quantity is positive. So now let's see how this approximation works. This approximation is infinitely good at one, and then in the middle here, it's very well, very good. But as you go away from one in this logarithmic scale symmetrically, it grows very fast. So the spectrum of your operator is not something you can play with. It lands somewhere, and it has this form. So apparently, eigenvalues that are in this region here are not very well approximated. So the only thing that you can do here, there is no flexibility in this approximation. The only thing that you can change is LS, basically. So this is a problem of this formulation that doesn't give you flexibility. But there was one situation where by changing the gauge action, it changes the eigenvalue spectrum of the kernel operator. And as a result, you have this dramatic improvement if you use this action DPW2 or Iwasaki, or even Szymanczyk action gives you one loop improved, double improved. Szymanczyk action gives you a substantial improvement over the standard Wilson gauge action. Unfortunately, for dynamical fermions at 1 GeV cutoff, you only get a factor of 2 improvement. So it's not a big help there. Because the configurations are very rough. No, why it doesn't work for the dynamical case, I don't understand why. The DPW2 axon doesn't smooth enough the configurations. That's it's not it's a tautology. It's not an understanding, but that's what happens. To Wilson kernel. This is the statement, the official statement from RBC, which it was given to me. I didn't participate in checking this statement. I think at this point they have tried many things by changing the gauge action in various ways unsuccessfully, and they haven't been able to fix the problem for the dynamical calculation by changing the gauge action. So by now you will probably understood that domain wall fermions are rather inflexible, and maybe why should we use them? Let's use something else, where, for example, the standard overlap has many tricks already that we have heard. You have the Zolotarev coefficients, you have continued fraction, double pass, nested iterations, all those things that have been developed by people. So now, but domain wall fermions have a nice physical picture, at least to me. The fact that you can get this as an effective theory in the boundary of the five-dimensional space, it looks rather appealing to me. There is has a practical implication. You have a partially conserved axial current, which you can use. It's a cheap thing to calculate to fix your renormalization constant for the local axial current, which you use for all your matrix element calculations. And yeah, but this is at zero cost, really.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so the five-dimensional action is local, and that's a very good feature for new algorithms that have been developed in the market recently by Lucer, for example, that take advantage of the locality of the action. So that could be a crucial factor. But also there are other five-dimensional implementations that can be probably twisted and be used in this manner. So the five-dimensional aspect is very, very interesting. Finally, for the dynamical calculation, the computation of the force becomes slightly easier because of this explicit five-dimensional linear system that you have. And furthermore, as probably you have heard by Frommert last week, computing the inverse of the matrix is cheaper than computing the matrix and then inverting it. But again, we would like a little bit more flexibility for this particular domain wall five-dimensional implementation. So I'm going now to talk about what these Möbius fermions are. And this is an attempt to explain in a few graphs. So the original domain wall fermion has this form where you have in the diagonal something that contains the Wilson kernel. And on the off-diagonal, this is in the basis of LS, you have hops forward and backward in the fifth dimension with the chiral projectors. So this is the basic structure of the matrix. Now, what we did with the Mobius is we replaced that matrix with another matrix that contains these D-minus operators associated with the chiral projectors. So these D-minus operators have a similar structure as the D-plus, the minus and the plus go for the middle, but with a different coefficient here. Now, in a sense, what happens is that apart from these straight hops in the fifth dimension, you have a hop and then and another hop coming from the D. Wilson. So this is the basic structure of this operator. Again, it's by using the same technology as the one that people used to solve the formula that I used before for the overlap operator that comes from the domain wall. You can use ILU decomposition and show that the 1-1 matrix element of this operator here is the overlap operator that you are after. And again, but now if you look at the approximation, what this kernel, which has this particular form, as you can see, this B5 plus C5 is one independent parameter of the B5 minus C5. So you can have this K parameter, which is independent from this A5, say the lattice spacing in the fifth dimension, if you want, you can call it like this. So you can tune independently those parameters. So this parameter here scales the spectrum, and this parameter actually can be used to shrink the spectrum. But it doesn't do, as we have found, doesn't do a very good job. Actually, it shrinks the spectrum a little bit, but it doesn't shrink it enough to help you. But this parameter here, the scaling, is the one that gives you the biggest gain. So as you can see, by taking particular values for these parameters, the scale and the A5, you can go to the standard overlap, which this transfer matrix was gamma 5 D. Wilson, or you can go to the standard domain wall fermion that Samir introduced, where those two parameters are the same, equal to 1. So this is a little bit more general form. So this is how it helps you. So for example, if you had this spectrum of your operator like this, by using the scale factor, you can now scale it, which in the logarithmic scale is a translation, and make it fit better to the window. And as you can see now, from up here, which was the maximal error, now has dropped down here. So this is what we hope to be doing with this scaling. We, as I said, this A5, we found that doesn't give you much, so you can fix it to whatever value if you want, so let's say 1. Again, here, this operator has exactly the same properties as the standard domain wall operator. It has a word identity, which comes from this vector-like rotations of the split-screen world. It has you can define the physical fermion fields on the boundaries. Now this definition is a little bit more complicated. It contains these D-minus operators that were not there before. But then the pseudoscalar density looks just like this was before, and the axial current has a few more terms because you have more hops in the four dimension than you used to have. But it's essentially the same thing as the standard Samir domain wall fermions, or for that matter, the same thing as the overlap operator if you change your parameters to go to the overlap, the Neuberger overlap. Now let's see, how do we try to measure the breaking of chiral symmetry? Obviously, the breaking of chiral symmetry comes from this term here. So if we take this operator to be the pseudoscalar density, and since this operator here is a pseudoscalar, at long distances, it could be proportional to the standard pseudoscalar density. So if you do use that proportionality and you call residual mass the proportionality constant, then you can absorb the effect of this operator into the fermionic mass as just an additive constant to the input fermionic mass. So we can measure this residual mass by using this ratio. This is precisely what it measures. But first we have to check that it's really a constant. And as you can see, this is on 15 configurations that RBC gave us with dynamical domain wall fermions. And it's within the statistics, it's pretty constant across the whole scale of time. So this is a good assumption that it's really just a constant. So this is how we measure the residual mass. Now, as I said before, this breaking of the Ginsberg-Wilson relation is related to how well you approximate the epsilon function. And it turns out with a little bit of algebra, you can show that this definition of residual mass is really related to this breaking term delta that appears in the Ginsberg-Wilson relation, as you should expect to happen. Now, one other technical aspect of this new brand of fermions is the fact that you can no longer do even odd preconditioning in the five-dimensional space as we used to do before. Yes. Yes. Yeah, because there are exactly, basically, the numerator is pi on the trace of g pi. Yeah. It should be. Ah, yeah, it's not delta squared, yes. Fine. Yes. It goes to a finite mass. We have, if you calculate that on the lattice, and you see that it's pretty constant, independent of the mass. How can you estimate what this operator here is?
No. But the dependence on Kaufman, the thing that divergence, is not that one.
Yeah, it's the other one, yes.
So, well, the other one is the okay, that one is
the but I think it is this. So the even odd preconditioning, as you know, Wilson-like fermions, here we have a five-dimensional Wilson-like fermion theory. You can do this even odd preconditioning. You split your lattice in even sides and odd sides, and the operator couples only even to odd sides, and then the diagonal piece that couples even to even, odd to odd, is a pretty trivial constant. So you can use this ILU decomposition, and you can restrict your space into the even or the odd sides. But now with the Möbius fermions, you have this extra dimension, this extra hop that doesn't allow you to do this decomposition. But fortunately, you can do this decomposition where you do even odd labeling in the four-dimensional space. And so all, in this is the fifth dimension, all sides on a given location, they are all even or they are all odd. And now you can play exactly the same game, but now this matrix is this even-even and odd-odd matrix. It's not a trivial number. It's a matrix, but which actually does not depend on the gauge field. That's not really essential. And it also it can be inverted in relatively few floating point operations. So you can actually do this preconditioning and get a factor of two speed up as you get with the standard Samir domain wall fermions. So here is our results for the quenched approximation beta 6, which is 2 GeV cutoff for this Möbius operator. We have tuned the scale parameter. This is the sequence of blue points is, or the sequence of red points is, have this A5 which is listed here, and also, but the scale parameter changes. So we find the optimum scale parameter for each value of A5. So the standard Samir domain wall fermions were the one that A5 equal to 1, the black points. This is what Colombia has been doing now. And if we want to stick to the same transfer matrix as RBC, then the A5 has to be equal to 1. These are the blue points. And you can see that for given MRes, which is 10 to the minus 3, this is the MRes that RBC is currently using, we gain a factor of 40% speed up. So you have to compare the MRes that you would have here, the cost. This is This is number of conjugate gradient of Dirac applications to invert the matrix. So you have 5,000 inversions application to invert the matrix to get this MRes, and here we have about 3,500. So you have a 40% speed up. And another thing to do is that as you increase LS, you can change the scale factor, and then you can see that you continue to drop almost exponentially the residual mass, while the standard Samir type of domain wall fermions flatten out. So if you insist on a very high precision, say order of 10^-4, so the speed up could be infinity, because you can actually achieve it this way and you cannot achieve it the other way. So now I'm coming to the topic that Tony touched yesterday, which is what's best for dynamical fermions. So this is work that we've been doing in collaboration with several people, which are listed up here. And so what we did is define the metric of efficiency, say at the fixed value of MRes, what it takes to invert the operator at fixed pion mass. So we took a sample of 15 configurations from RBC, which is with the lightest quark mass they had. We used Mobius and continued fraction in five dimensions with the Wilson kernel or the Samir kernel. So, and actually it's not 25, it's 15 configurations. And the question we ask is how much it takes to invert the matrix. I'm not going to present the figure that Tony presented yesterday, since you saw it, but I'm going to present the results that are related to the Mobius fermion. So one question that it's I think open is how small chiral symmetry breaking can we, actually how large chiral symmetry breaking can we tolerate? And I think the answer is that we don't have to have exact chiral symmetry. We can live with rather large chiral symmetry breaking and still be able to do QCD. But let me show the results for the residual mass. The green points are these Mobius fermions, and the black points are the RBC results for the dynamical run. For comparison, I've put in the quenched QCD results. This is the Wilson gauge action, the Iwasaki, and the DBW2. And you can see now with this change in the formulation of the action, we have made the dynamical domain wall fermion look the same as the Iwasaki to GeV. And we are working actually at a little bit coarser lattice. It's 1.7 GeV, not to be confused with the optimal scale, which is again 1.7. But plotting it against LS is not the relevant question. The relevant question is, this is a typo here. This is the number of Dirac application it takes to invert the matrix. And again, the green points are the Mobius fermion. The black points are the Samir. If you are happy with MRes 10^-3, there is no point of changing anything. Things work the same for all the things that we tested. If you are interested in going to, say, 10^-4, MRes, then you can see that there is an improvement between the new formulation and the standard Samir formulation, which we have been somewhere there. And for comparison, here I have put in the what we get if we use the Borici kernel, which is the D. Wilson. This is the standard Neuberger operator, and you can see that this five-dimensional implementation of the standard Neuberger operator is a little bit more expensive than than the Mobius that we're using. And we have also used an additional value for A5, this 0.5, which is in between the overlap, the original overlap, and the domain wall. And you can see that you don't have a real gain here. All this has been done at fixed pion mass. So now let me come back to the dependence on LS. So this is the pion mass, the change of the pion mass as a function of LS. These are jackknife differences, so because the lattices are we have correlated lattices, and it has been done on this is LHPC data on milk cockroach asking lattices. So you can see that as you increase the length, there is a dependence, a change on the pion mass, which doesn't seem to have plateaued out here, maybe. But so there is a noticeable change within the statistics. But where this change comes from? If we take the change of the square of the pion mass and divide it by the sum of the what we think MRES is and the quark mass, this has to be proportional to each other plus some higher correction terms. Now, if we take this ratio and we plot it as function of LS, if we see that now the this coefficient C that we extract from this ratio is not within errors, is in agreement with the coefficient we extract for any value of LS, LS 8, 16, 24, and 32. Within the statistics, again, it's jackknife errors here. So we can say that the most of the change of the pion mass is basically due to the change of the MRES. So in that sense, we can understand the change of the MRES, of the pion mass by only considering MRES. And the hope is that we can do that for many observables. One other comment here, if I plot the nucleon mass, which doesn't have a very strong quark mass dependence, then this variation that I had in the previous slide as a function of LS is not there. All the points from LS 16 and on, they are basically in agreement with LS 16. So for this particular calculation, we have chosen LS 16 to do it. So the point I wanted to make is that by using the MRES, we can actually take into account this residual coalescing symmetry breaking to a pretty good degree. Now let me go back to the Zolotarev polynomials, which you've heard yesterday. So another way of approximating the epsilon function is using this ratio of polynomials, where these are coefficients that you put there, and you can put arbitrary values for these coefficients. If you look at the now, there is an optimal set of these coefficients which has been discovered by Zolotarev, actually, which makes the error uniform across the interval that you want to have a good approximation of the epsilon function. Now, if you look at the errors, this 1 minus epsilon squared that appears in the Ginsberg-Wilson relation, the breaking of the Ginsberg-Wilson relation, then it has this particular form. And as you can see, there are the roots, the error becomes zero when x is plus or minus the value of those coefficients that you put here. So one comment I wanted to make about this form of the error is that you can have a poor man's projection. Suppose that you have a given configuration which has a very small eigenvalue which you want to project out. You can enlarge your LS by 1 and put this coefficient here to be 1 over your eigenvalue, and then run your domain wall, and then it would project out exactly this eigenvalue. So now, because the standard implementation of Zolotarev, you have different roots. They come out to be single roots, so the error becomes zero with a single root. So it fluctuates between positive and negative. That tells me that the residual mass is not positive anymore. So that allows you the possibility of exceptional configurations, because as you saw yesterday, there are some configurations that have an abnormally large MRES, which could be 10 to the minus 3. So if you're simulating at a quark mass of 10 minus 3, then you will hit an exceptional configuration there. So, but this is not a big problem, because you can alleviate it by requiring that you have double zeros. And here is an example of such situation, which I put double zeros here. And it's probably as good as the Zolotarev, this kind of approximation. So unfortunately, there is no Freeland's theorem is not violated. Although Zolotarev loops very good, you can tune your interval to be exactly the interval of your eigenvalues, and you can have a very good error across the whole interval. That doesn't quite work for the Mobius formulation. If you put any of the A5s larger than 5, say, the cost of the computation explodes. So it's completely impractical to use it. For that matter, other five-dimensional implementations, such as those that Tony talked yesterday, are seemingly at this point to be better than the Mobius. But what I think is that we need to find a better preconditioner for this particular Mobius matrix with Zolotarev. And we do have some ideas we are currently exploring, and we hope that we could do better, much better than what we're doing right now. Now, let me go to a little bit more speculative things about what we need to do in the future in terms of algorithms. We have to improve the Hadron Monte Carlo. The cost of Hadron Monte Carlo with current machines, so machines that we have at JLabs, for example, is so high that we need to find a way of improving things. So there are two objectives that we need to try here. One is to improve the accuracy of chiral symmetry. Increasing LS is not going to help, because as you saw, in certain cases, by just increasing LS, you don't get much reduction of the chiral symmetry breaking. Also, this five-dimensional Hadron Monte Carlo scales badly with the five-dimensional volume, so this is a problem we need to address in some way. Another actual problem that it's actually more critical is the critical slowing down. It is the most important thing, because the biggest cost of the calculation comes from the simulating light quark masses. So we need to try to address that. Up to now, there have been, for domain wall fermions, again, I'm not talking about other variants of chiral fermions here, we have used, there are two different ways that have been simulated. One is by this explicit simulation of the Pauli-Villar fields that it's a bosonic field that cancels the bulk of the five-dimensional space, and an explicit simulation of the fermionic piece. It has been shown by RBC that if you don't do that and you combine your two operators into a common operator, then you get a certain advantage. But still, you have to integrate over pseudo-fermion fields that lie all over LS, and you actually only need the zero component of that. So you should be able to reduce this algorithm to a purely four-dimensional implementation that would hopefully behave a little bit better. So another thing that new hybrid Monte Carlo algorithms contain is the following. It's basically the preconditioned hybrid Monte Carlo, where if you are trying to simulate this particular determinant, you can simulate another determinant that's actually cheaper, and then use this correction term to make up for the error that you made. So in terms, now you need to use two pseudo-fermion fields to exponentiate the two different pieces. But now if this matrix here is cheap, and the preconditioner, and it's a good approximation of the matrix that you want to calculate, this whole piece will not have a large force. So you can update this infrequently, and you can update the cheap piece very frequently, which will give you larger forces. So this is the basic idea behind two algorithms that have been suggested recently by Lusser, the Schwarz alternating procedure. Of course, he does a lot of algebra in this piece, and he is able to reduce the number of degrees of freedom of this additional pseudo-fermion substantially. And another algorithm which has been put forward by Hasenbusch and Janssen. Hopefully, we can develop new preconditioners for the domain wall fermion, which are specifically designed to take advantage of this particular problem. And hence, if we have a preconditioner, you can turn it into a hybrid Monte Carlo in that way, with a multi-step type of technique. So I'm coming to the conclusions. As I said, dynamical chiral fermions with cool chiral symmetry require enormous resources. So you have to be very ingenious in figuring out what algorithms we are going to use, because we simply don't have the resources right now. We need every possible trick we can make. And then this is a quote by Herbert Neuberger from one of his papers, which is, I think, still in time. So So we are currently working on improving the hybrid Monte Carlo. We're thinking about new preconditioners that will have both the hybrid Monte Carlo and the inversion of the Dirac operator. And I'm very optimistic that things will develop in the near future that will substantially speed up the current simulations. Thank you.